Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600, and thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks.
A look at what's happening across Connecticut. Melissa in the Morning's conversation with Governor Ned Lamont. Now on WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
Governor Lamont, welcome back to the morning show. How are you? Thank you so much for being here, Governor Lamont. I know we have a lot of listener questions for you this morning, so I'm glad that we have you. First and foremost, this was a new story that the DEA put out there nationwide. Connecticut has not landed on the list yet, but if I were to make an educated guess, I believe we're going to very soon. If not, it's already here. It just hasn't been detected. Rainbow fentanyl. It attracts the attention of young people. It comes in a pill or a powder form, and it's exactly what it kind of sounds like. It's all kinds of rainbow pastel colors. Some of it even looks like the chalk that kids would use on the sidewalk. My question to you, Governor, is what can we do here in Connecticut to better educate children and families about the dangers of drugs, especially fentanyl use?
Yeah, good question. I mean, obviously on the enforcement side, come down like a ton of bricks on these pushers. I consider this many cases like a murder weapon, lacing things with fentanyl, rainbow fentanyl, often entrapping these kids. You know, secondly, it starts at home. It starts around the kitchen table. It starts with moms and dads and big brothers and big sisters talking to their siblings. We're doing a lot at the schools. That's where we can take the lead, starting with coaches and teachers and counselors there. I think they could be a first line, or at least they could be a radar system and give parents some indication if they see any issues coming up. And just be very clear that this is dangerous and wrong. And if you see something, say something.
Governor Lamont, I was telling my listeners about the instance, the horrific instance we had earlier in the last school year, where I believe it was in Hartford, where a young child ingested something. I can't remember if it was fentanyl, in fact, but two other kids went to the hospital. The whole school had to shut down because they didn't want it to end up in the vents or on the floors and get anybody else sick. You know, whatever came of that instance?
One of the first things we did is we certainly got Narcan and other related things at our schools or nearby on site, making it easier for us to deal with something like this. And secondly, just working very closely with our schools, making sure, like I said, that they are an early line of defense, making sure they're aware of telltale signs, having counselors there, the big commitment we made to mental health. You know, your question was right. We can only do so much with enforcement. It really is about a prevention and the making sure that these kids know that this is dangerous, potentially fatal.
Mm-hmm. And I know you and I have talked about the DARE program, how it used to be here. It's not anymore. It was brought to my attention why it isn't here anymore. And some districts have adopted what's called now like SHARE. In Fairfield, I guess they have what's called the SHARE program, which actually is more than just talking about drugs and alcohol. It talks about much more than that. And it's been put into the school systems there. Do you know if this is something a lot of other districts are adopting? And if not, is there something the state could do to kind of, I don't want to say enforce, I don't like using that word, but establish this in more school districts to have programs, you know, even at the elementary level to inform kids and even parents?
Well, yeah, Melissa, we have certainly, A, supported programs like that. B, our schools have a lot of additional resources. C, as you point out, a lot of towns and districts are doing this themselves right now. I think it's one more line of defense. I think it makes good sense.
And what about, you had mentioned Narcan, like in the schools in Hartford. Do you know if more districts followed suit with that and have invested in putting Narcan in their schools?
It was not in the schools that's readily accessible nearby, but we had a broad expansion of that and the training for that. That's not the answer to the problem, but it could save some lives.
Okay. We're talking to Governor Lamont this morning. Another top story this week, a high school football game actually right here in Bridgeport was postponed last night because of a social media threat. And recently, the FCAC had to change the rules for fans because they're simply unruly. There have been more instances in the last 2 years where negative comments have been made from people in the stands to athletes, student athletes, and it's impacting them mentally and certainly emotionally. And I'm wondering from your standpoint, what can we do to better protect the safety of our athletes, not just mentally and emotionally, but even physically, because I do think people get a little rowdy, a little cray-cray.
Well, first of all, on the social media, remember back in my era, you don't cry fire in a crowded theater. Well,
yeah.
Now the crowded theater is social media, and it streaks across the landscape. One thing about social media, you often can track down the person that launched that that threat, and we ought to come down on them like a ton of bricks as well. This is, potentially shutting down schools, closing up football games. You can't be too careful when you get a threat. You've got to act. But I want to go after these, especially these actors on social media. More broadly, come on, parents. You're going to a football game. You want to win. You want your kid to do well. But you're also there to support a team. You're there to support sportsmanship and the values represented by a team sport. So I think we ought to stand up and hold ourselves to that higher standard.
Yeah, it is surprising. Sometimes I can remember from my high school days going to some of the very intense. I went to Laurelton, so when I'd go to the Fairfield Prep football games, they got very intense. And I mean, I get it. These kids could be going to Division I schools for sports. So I get the competitiveness, but sometimes the very colorful language that would come out, I'm like, that's a 15-year-old. Why are you saying that? I don't know. I just, it can be quite intense. And I don't mean to laugh about it and make light of it. I know it's a very serious issue, but I mean, I don't know. Sometimes I'm just very surprised by people. We're talking to Governor Lamont this morning, taking your questions. And by the way, thank you to Gary McNamara. It's called the SHAPE program. I called it SHARE. I must have been trying to rhyme with DARE, but the SHAPE program. So sorry about that. Thank you for the correction.
And Melissa, I'll tell you one slightly funny story. So I have a daughter, Emily, and she was playing 12-year-old soccer, and all the dads are getting passionate on the sidelines. And I gave my daughter, Emily, a very spirited arousal. Let's go. Get moving. Speed up. You're slow. And then I realized there are five other girls on the team named Emily, and they're all looking at me.
Oh, no. So you were that guy.
Physician, heal thyself. Yeah.
Oh, how funny. Yeah, well, that'll happen. That is so funny. And she was, what, 12, you said?
Yeah, something like that.
Oh, how hysterical. Well, serves you right, Governor Lamont. Don't cheer for anybody. Just stand there and clap. We are talking to Governor Ned Lamont this morning, taking your questions. And as we talk about education, just one more question for you, Governor. Obviously, this was a pretty upsetting and disturbing story. I do know it's under investigation, so you don't have to comment specifically on this individual, but more on the story itself. As I'm sure you've heard, the Greenwich assistant principal who was caught on camera, whether people think it was done maliciously, if it was done sneakily, if it's legit or it's not, comments that he made have now put his job fully at jeopardy. And it is pending an investigation. But talking about the hiring process of how he brings in teachers specifically for like a political agenda. That was a very disturbing story. Another one that has been really continuing on is the Plymouth story, the Plymouth teachers who are accused of helping to hide another teacher who's been accused of sexually abusing students. So these have been two very difficult stories for Connecticut families to process in the last few weeks. And I'm just curious, if you could just speak to the fact that what are we doing to hold teachers accountable, especially while we are dealing with a severe teacher shortage right now and we're desperate for teachers?
First of all, you mentioned the investigation. We got to find out whether this is one-off or is it part of something bigger. I hate these gotcha guys that hire a pretty girl and serve some dude a few extra drinks and he starts saying something stupid. I like to think it's a one-off incident like that, but I don't know. And what he said was repulsive, and he should be forced to step aside, at least pending this investigation. And as regards the other case, say the same thing. Err on the side of transparency. Don't try and cover anything up so you don't disturb people. I think people want to know you're making a good faith effort to get to the bottom of this. Is this something that is more system-wide? I think it's more local to that one incident. We got to find out.
So do you think, Governor Lamont, these are two stories, for example, that's only making a problem that Connecticut's dealing with right now, which is teacher shortages, even harder to find good teachers?
What I do think makes it harder is people knocking our teachers and somehow dividing teachers and parents. Our education system works best, I think, when parents work closely with teachers and we get the best schools in the world. We attract the best and the brightest teachers, and that involves respecting the teachers and giving them the latitude to teach. So we're pretty good on hiring. Now, some of our urban schools still have a shortage. Many of their teachers go out to the suburbs because it may be a little more relaxing teaching. But we're gearing up. We're ramping up. We're getting apprentice teachers in the classroom. You don't have to spend that third year of teacher college. You know, you can spend some of that time in the classroom. We'll pay you to be there. So we get a little additional support. We got a lot of retired teachers coming back as well. So we had a good opening to our school year, last week, much better even than it was last year, not to mention the year before. And I think people feel pretty good about where our schools are and that they're back.
And I have one last school-related question, and then I'll switch gears to transportation. Pretty rough situation going on in Mansfield earlier this week. They had their opening day. Then they had to cancel the next day because the bus routes were such a disaster. And now we're at the end of just the first week. And it's still a disaster where kids haven't even gotten off the bus until 6:30 at night. Our partners at News 8 were telling us. Unfortunately, bus driver shortage is also a huge issue, and kids being stuck on buses for too long and even being dropped off at the wrong bus stops as well. What are you doing, Governor, to oversee how bus companies are handling, really, again, very hard times? Because I know we have a lot of wonderful bus drivers right now, but we are seeing a lot of issues with the buses, too.
I'll just pull the lens back for a second. We have real labor shortages in very many areas. We talked about teachers a minute ago. You just referenced bus drivers. I can tell you it's true in nursing. I can tell you it's true in advanced manufacturing. I can tell you it's true in state police. What we are doing is doing everything we can to get more people qualified to work faster at less cost. We've had one of the highest labor participation rates in the country. Ours is going up. But we still have a long way to go, and I want to make sure everybody gets that opportunity. And in this case, that means more bus drivers who are trained and ready to do the job.
So we're talking to Governor Lamont this morning, and speaking of buses, we'll transition to some transportation questions we have this morning. One that has consistently come up on WACC from a lot of our listeners. As you know, Governor, last month, California made a huge announcement with plans to ban sales of new gas cars by 2035, requiring all vehicles to be electric or hydrogen powered. And now we know that many other states are kind of trying to decide if they want to have a similar mandate. I know right off the top of my head, Massachusetts, New York, Vermont, they are all expected to adopt this exact same ban, which is, which a lot of people have mixed feelings on. Where does Connecticut stand with this? Are we following suit, or do we want to follow suit with California?
Well, first, we have in the past when it came to fuel efficiency standards, which I think was really good. And I am talking to our neighboring governors, see what we should do along this way. I think it probably makes pretty good sense. I did talk to, Ford and General Motors. You know, they're already on track to have 2035 as a date that they go all electric. And they're ramping up between now and then. And so they sort of like the idea that we're being clear about where we want our state to be, where we want our country to be. 10 years out. I think they're doing it gradually, and I think they're doing it thoughtfully, and I think I'll urge the legislature to strongly consider this.
What do we think, Governor, and you and I know have talked about this before, but I know this is a listener question I get a lot. What do we think, though, about the potential of these car fires with the battery issues that we've seen before? We just not that long ago saw it happen to an electric bus, and then the whole fleet was taken out of commission because of it. I know there's a lot of concerns about that and the fact that they're manufactured out of the country.
Well, I mean, more and more of the electric cars are being manufactured right in this country, and that's part of what this initiative is about. As regards to those battery fires, they're extremely rare but very worrisome. And right now, you know, we had that one related to one of our municipal buses. Transportation folks from the feds came down, investigated, seen if this was one-off or unique, or there's something systemic that we have to look at in terms of all the batteries. Right now, we think it's one-off and unique, but I think the investigation is still ongoing.
And as far as buses are concerned, I've gotten this question a couple of times. Are you open, Governor, if you do get reelected in November, are you open to the idea of eliminating bus fares a little bit longer beyond the date that's already set? I believe it's December 1st, or maybe it's a different date.
I am. I think it's been pretty successful, and I know that our ridership is up quite a bit. It means it's a lot more affordable for a folk where they can take the bus rather than have to get a car or have to pay for the bus. It makes life a lot more affordable. It gets a few cars off the road. I think that makes sense. You know, I am the guy that's got to pay the bills, so we have a lot of transportation infrastructure we got to pay for. But I'm pretty sure we'll be able to do both, keep the buses free and pay for what we need to pay for.
So just to clarify, Governor, as of right now, when are the bus fares being reinstated? I forgot.
Right now it's December 1.
Okay. That's what I thought. I was just making sure. Okay. But you are open to extending that?
I am.
And then my last question for you, Governor, this actually, I know Ansonia tried to bring it into place, but they didn't end up doing it. Bridgeport, I believe, did a similar idea. I think even Hartford as well. Electric scooters. You know, it's interesting. I spent my last weekend in Nashville. They are big on the electric scooters over there to try to cut down on a lot of cars being on the roads and things like that. What do you think about trying to have something like that established in more of our cities and even towns? Like I look at a Fairfield or a Milford, they're not considered obviously, you know, like a New Haven or a Bridgeport or a Hartford, but you know, they're big. Like I look at both of them are over 60,000 people and they're huge. They span, you know, that those scooters could be very helpful.
Look, I think it makes a very good sense. I here in Hartford, so I see people using them more and more frequently. You know, previously I had worried, oh, my God, these things seem accident prone and watch out. But I think we've had something like a year of experience. I haven't heard a lot of incidents in that sense. Look, we'll leave it up to Fairfield or whatever towns. They can make their own decisions on this. But I think it's look, I want cities to be more walkable. I don't want everybody having to hop into a car to go anywhere. I like the idea of bicycles. I like the idea of scooters. And I like the idea of free buses, all things that mean you don't have to get into a car.
Well, Governor Lamont, I really appreciate you coming on, giving us the extra time as always. And I look forward to chatting with you again in just a couple of weeks. Have a wonderful weekend.
You too, Melissa. Enjoy, everybody.
Well,
thank
Stratford,
you so much.
I'm
That's
glad
Governor
to have
Ned Lamont
here
on WICC.
And the rest of you listening to WICC, we have Laura Devlin back on the show, who is the Republican candidate running for a lieutenant governor here in Connecticut. Good morning, Laura. Welcome back.
Hi, Melissa. Thank you so much.
Yeah,
happy
glad to
join
you
this morning.
Yes, I'm very glad to have you as well. We do have some listener questions for you. For starters, I know, and you know, for people who are asking questions that I think are a little more Bob-centric, Bob Stefanowski, you know, you guys are a pair. You guys are a team. So I'll ask these questions as well. First one is from the news earlier this week that Bob Stefanowski with his – they're calling it the Parental Bill of Rights. I think the thing that people have been really focused on is transgender athletes. And this is something we've talked about on my show several times. I don't really give an opinion on it because nobody really cares about my opinion. But I know it's something that's been very controversial. We've had, you know, Connecticut athletes, even here in Fairfield County, who have been feel that they've been discriminated against because of transgender athletes being either competing against them or joining their teams. Could you talk a little bit about what the vision would be if you and Bob entered office in November?
So this really comes down to a safety issue above and all, you know, everything else. We both totally support acceptance, diversity, tolerance of all people. But what the data shows is that there are clearly physiological differences between males and females. And, you know, even as young as 12, but even before that, whether it has to do with, you know, heart and lung aerobic capacity, bones and skeletal structure, muscle mass, muscle strength, any of those things. And for biological males to compete with girls and young women in high school sports, it's really unsafe and it's unfair. So right now, CIAC has their ruling, and we would work with them to amend their policy. And then if needed, we would certainly work with the legislature to be able to enforce the protections that have been provided to girls and women under Title IX in the state of Connecticut.
So, you know, Laura, what I find hard about today's world is I do think we, you know, I think we're trying to be more aware of acceptance and inclusivity and not judgment. Yeah. Like, those are all really great things. But I have to be honest, I have asked this question for several years because well before the Trump era and I'll call it the woke era and things like that, and not even getting into politics, I've asked many politicians before, or even doctors, and I cannot get a straight answer. I have said, when is a transition complete? That's just a medical question I've asked. So if somebody decides or they feel that they were born the wrong gender and they go through a transition, I've asked this question, I don't know how many times. When are you officially, like, transitioned, if you will? And I can never get a straight answer. And I think that alone is, you know, it's fine if you recognize that, you know, I personally feel that I'm this gender and I want to be respected for that and I want to be treated equal. That's perfectly fine. But from a physical standpoint, from like a science standpoint, are you, you know, I've asked this, at what age or how many years or how long, like how do we know when a male's body becomes a female body? When does it become where you are DNA wise, like if you will? When do you actually become transition? And I can't get a straight answer about that. And I worry that even as I'm talking about this openly now, that people are going, well, you're discriminating. But I'm not. I'm asking that question because if we can't even get a straight answer, this is going to become, or it's going to continue to be controversial. Because it sounds like you've got one side who's like, look, this is a safety issue, this is an unfair issue, and then you have another side that's saying you just are not open to change. And I think that's a very black and white way of looking at it. I think there is a gray area, but people just don't want to touch it. Do you find that that's, you know, sort of where we're living?
Yeah. And you know what, Melissa? I was in a gray area for a real long time, right? Because it's like, oh, sure, of course, why not? But I got introduced to a woman, Kim Jones, out of Darien, and has started this international organization called ICONS. And I met with her, and then I also received this big report, and I'd be happy to share it with you in some way, but I also read it cover to cover and read the whole section on the data and the science. And after going through this, you know, it is, it became very black and white to me. And it's not about discrimination. It's not about trying to not be inclusive. The fact of the matter is biologically, boys and girls are different. And it is, as I mentioned earlier, it has to do with one thing even related to the way tendons are formed in a knee. I mean, there are very clear differences that to me, it made it black and white, and I totally support, you know, the position that we laid out this past week in terms of protecting girls' sports. And I think the move to change Title IX is the wrong direction to go. Title IX was put in place specifically to provide opportunities for girls and women in sports, and there's, you know, moves to make changes to that too.
We're talking to Laura Devlin this morning, the Republican candidate for lieutenant governor. If you have specific questions for her, please feel free to call in 203-333-9422, or you can always email me directly as well. Some other things I wanted to talk about this morning, Laura, if you don't mind. One of our top stories, even though it hasn't been technically detected here in Connecticut, I'm going to make the educated guess that it's probably here or it's on its way here. It's been detected for sure in 18 other states. The DEA is warning the nation about what's called rainbow fentanyl, and it's specifically attracting the attention of young people. And I'm wondering what you and Bob think about the idea of reinstating something like a DARE program in schools, because I know we can, you know, we can argue till we're blue in the face about whether or not there should be a wall up. You know, we know that the border is a disaster, but it's here. Like, it's here now, and we've already made the mess that we have as a country. So what can we do here in Connecticut to better protect our kids from things like fentanyl?
Yeah, so, and, you know, to your point, though, if fentanyl enters our country through that southern border, something has to be done because
I agree.
It is killing
totally. People
across our state. So I know there was a transition away from the DARE program, and I believe in Fairfield now, for example, we have a program called SHAPE, and the acronyms cover a broader array of things than just drug education. So not only has the sort of the breadth of the program expanded, the hours allotted to treat this have also diminished. So, yeah, I think Bob and I have not talked about this, first of all. So I am just sharing my reaction to this latest news. I have also not talked to our local law enforcement. But I, from my own kids experiencing the DARE program, I thought it was very effective. Mm-hmm. And clearly, we need to do something because what's happening now is incredibly frightening, and nobody is immune from the risks of what is happening.
Yeah, I agree. Laura Devlin is here. She's the Republican candidate for lieutenant governor, taking our questions this morning. And we were just talking about drugs, specifically fentanyl. We know that the border's a disaster, and we've known that. We've even had, you know, people from both sides admit that. I can't tell you how many times, countless times, Congressman Himes has come on this show and said it's a disaster at the border. So we know that fentanyl is here. We knew it was coming. Obviously, we were very divided as a nation, and here we are. So we've got this new type of fentanyl that apparently is attracting young people. It's called rainbow fentanyl. And what it is it comes in pill and powder form. Sometimes it looks like almost like the chalk that our kids use on the sidewalks. Other times it looks like almost like the Flintstones vitamins that we used to take as kids. It's like those kinds of colors. And what's concerning, Laura, is you and I were talking about the DARE program, for example, which I know dissolved a while ago. I went through the DARE program when I was at North Stratfield Elementary School in Fairfield. Loved it. Learned so much from it. And I do think it was really impactful, especially when it came to just trying things like pills or, you know, like a heroin or cocaine or something like that. I felt like my generation didn't really touch that stuff too much, maybe more of like the Molly or marijuana, like in the college days. Again, I'm speaking generally, not for myself, but I feel like the DARE program did a number on our generation, at least. And I was very sad to see that it kind of dissolved. So I know you haven't spoken about this with Bob, but I do hope it's something you guys talk about, because I don't know if it's a financial thing. I would imagine that's why DARE is not something. But what do you think about even sending police officers in to do presentations or something like that at schools? Because I do know other states, for example, I think Pennsylvania right now is sending even DEA officers like into elementary schools to talk about this drug specifically. But what do you think about that?
Yeah, so I think we have to do something, because these drugs, and like you painted, you know, the picture of, and if anybody just sort of looks online, you can see what these pills look like. They are more available, they are more deadly, and it's not like try it once and, oh, I don't think I care for that, I won't try it again. It's like try it once and you're likely to not live anymore.
Right.
So this is extremely serious, and we need to be able to have not resources that are sort of diluted among, you know, anything else. And I think also, you know, you mentioned your conversation with Congressman Himes and saying, oh, yeah, it's a mess. Well, that's Congress's responsibility, and our federal government, they've got to stop saying it's a mess, and they have got to take action. This is a crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And the youth in our certainly in our communities, our state, but in our country, are at risk, mm-hmm. and they're clearly being targeted.
No question.
It's unprecedented. It's unbelievable.
It absolutely is. And I'm of the belief, Laura, like, look, I have a 4-year-old. I think I've become a different reporter since having kids. But, you know, I'm certainly of the belief of, I absolutely agree, on a national level, we are just royally messing this up. And we have been, and we've known the signs for a long time. But on a state level, you know, I think as long as it's here and we're dealing with it and it's either on its way to Connecticut or it's here already, you know, I think that we have to take a proactive stance and figure out, all right, how do we let kids know in 3rd, 4th, 5th grade, like, hey, these things exist. Please don't just take drugs from strangers. Like, I think that's an area that, you know, when we talk about education, you know, we've kept things like sex ed, you know, in the classroom, like for middle school age students. But things like drugs and alcohol, I've noticed, like my own sisters who are of the generation behind me, they did not go through that. They never went through an alcohol and drug prevention program like we did in the 90s. That's just something they did not have in their schools by the time they went. And I think it did a huge disservice, honestly. I mean, my sisters, thank God, are fine and they've done nothing wrong. But a lot of their friends have gone down really awful, slippery paths, and they're good kids. But they tried things and it was a horrible mistake. But I don't know. I think we have to take a proactive approach somehow with families and kids, because it's at the national level, it's not in a good place.
No, and I know that we all know somebody, myself included, that has been, you know, hurt by drugs. And it is, we've got to protect our kids, absolutely. And I think it's a conversation we need to have. You know, the police officers who were part of the DARE program, who also do the SHAPE program, they go through training. They are trained in how to present this information. And I think it also builds relationships with our law enforcement, which is really important to have.
Yeah, we need that, too. Out of curiosity, Laura, and then I'll let you go. How much is SHAPE? Like, do Fairfield taxpayers pay for SHAPE, or how is that funded?
So that is a good question. I don't know. So I'm going to have to, I'll start with, I don't know, right?
That's fine. I'll take that. That's okay.
It may be grant funded. It may be part of the police budget. But it is a broader program now than what DARE did, and it's far less hours than the focused presentation of what DARE was all about.
Hmm. Interesting. So, I'm wondering if why more districts don't have this, and also when you say far less hours, that are you saying that in a good way or a bad way? Because I would think that's not a good thing.
No, I don't think that's a good thing. I think in the DARE program there were 450 hours of instruction. I am just looking at this from the Fairfield Police website. You should get our chief on your program and talk to him.
I do love the chief. I will.
It's 234 hours. So it is a broader kind of, you know, topic area and half the amount of time to talk about it.
Interesting.
But I do believe this is a crisis, and we need to be serious about protecting our kids.
Yeah, I agree. Well, Laura, I really appreciate you coming on this morning, and I thank you so much. And I definitely am going to make some calls and see if I can either get the chief on or even like a Gary McNamara or somebody to come back on the show and talk about this SHAPE program, because I don't know much about it. Yeah, I think that would be really great. And I always appreciate you coming on the show, answering our questions. Thank you so much. And I look forward to chatting with you really soon.
Thank you, Melissa. Have a great day.
Thank you. You too. That is Laura Devlin, who is the Republican candidate for lieutenant governor here on WICC. This video that unfortunately is probably not sounding very audible and you can't see it at home, let me just explain to you. It's pretty graphic. It's a horse that collapsed after pulling a carriage in New York City, and you're hearing his handler saying, just get up, get up, get up. This was a video that became public last month, showing the horse collapse in the middle of a street during rush hour. I mean, you could see a massive bus and cars surrounding this horse. police watering down the fallen horse that had animal rights groups protesting outside of City Hall. And then the incident reignited calls for the city to ban horse carriages in New York City. You may remember back in July, I had the group Last Chance for Animals on, which was very supportive of an effort to try and ban horse-drawn carriages. And there's actually a bill right now that's already been introduced. It's being debated in New York City to remove the horse-drawn carriages and replace them with electric ones by June of 2024. This, to me, is a story that matters because it is in such close proximity to us here in Connecticut. And to be honest, many of you, including myself, have been on one of these horse-drawn carriages. And until it becomes very clear the issue that is happening right next door to us, people are going to continue to support a very abusive thing that's happening in the Big Apple, and that's horse-drawn carriages. So I thought I'd continue to bring awareness to this story and let you know about it so you don't support what's going on in the horrible nature that these horses are living through right now. PETA Director Ashley Byrne is here to talk more about horse-drawn carriages in New York City. Ashley, welcome to the show. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you for having me.
So tell us, Ashley, how long this has been an issue for, specifically in New York City. They've been doing horse-drawn carriages for a very, very long time.
Oh, yes. This campaign has been going on for decades, at least since the 80s. But really, I think even before that, there were New Yorkers who were concerned about having horses pulling carriages in traffic in one of the busiest cities in the world.
So why do you think it continues to happen then, Ashley? It seems very odd when you think about it. It seems almost archaic that we still have horse-drawn carriages, but right next to them are taxis and buses and people flying down the roads and just congestion. Like, it just doesn't really fit. If that makes sense, it just doesn't really make sense with today's world that we would have horse-drawn carriages, it seems like.
Oh, it's absurd. I mean, of course, traffic in New York City just keeps getting busier and more congested. We all know that the weather in the summer and winter just keeps getting more extreme. The conditions for these horses keep getting worse. They keep getting more dangerous. And of course, the cruelty just keeps intensifying. And yet this industry remains on the streets of New York City. And the thing is, people don't support this anymore. I mean, New Yorkers don't. When that terrible accident went viral in August, there was just this universal outcry of people saying, how is this still happening? This should have been gone years ago. And the truth is, it's really just red tape and some people digging in their feet at City Hall that's stopping this. I mean, if it was up to New Yorkers, this industry would be banned because people who live around Central Park, who spend time in the park, they don't, you know, they see the cruelty firsthand. At PETA, we hear from people all the time saying that they saw a horse and they were concerned about, you know, the conditions, that they saw a horse who looked skinny or sick or tired or, you know, or the driver was mistreating them. And what they find over and over again is that they get no help from the city when they try to report these incidents. It's really, this should have been banned years ago. But the very least we can do is ban it now.
Ashley Byrne is the PETA director. We're talking about horse-drawn carriages in New York City and an effort to ban them because, quite simply, the horses are going through animal cruelty. I'm curious, Ashley, then, is it because tourists still support the nature of this business? Like, if New Yorkers are so against it, if people are even, like, here in Connecticut are aware of it, are we talking about tourists who are still supporting it? Like, I would think if people are so aware of the nature of this, that these horse-drawn carriages, they wouldn't have, you know, like, they wouldn't be making money. But is it because we have tourists who all go into New York City and have no idea or don't have a regard, or it's so... I mean, it's made to be very appealing. It's made to be part of the Big Apple experience. Like, is that the issue that's still keeping them afloat?
That is precisely the issue. And of course, you know, there are tourists who are learning about this and refusing to take these rides now as well. But the tourist industry is what is keeping it alive. Mm. And the fact is, tourists have so many other options, and this terrific bill that's been proposed would give them another option. It would replace the horse carriages with horseless electric carriages. So you'd have that kind of antique charm without the suffering, without the danger. But it is. It's the tourist industry that is keeping it going. And also, it's just the fact that the industry is represented by the Transit Workers Union. They're very powerful in New York City. And so they've been able to prevent progress on this, unfortunately.
We're talking about horse-drawn carriages in New York City. It's a very popular tourist attraction, and unfortunately, it's kind of what's keeping the business afloat, even though many people who are local know that these horses are not being treated well. They haven't been treated well for several decades, and that there's a bill right now that's just kind of sitting, and we're seeing what's going to happen with it. It would ban horse-drawn carriages in New York City by the year 2024 and turn them into electric carriages, which Ashley Byrne is here, who's a PETA director. I mean, that's a really great alternative for people. It still gives you that nostalgia feel of being on a carriage and going around New York City. But it hasn't seen as much movement as people would like to see. So, Ashley, my question for you this morning, if people are listening, what can they do? What can the average person do? I know this is a tourist issue. So are there simple things we could be doing right now to let people know, hey, if you're coming to the Big Apple, don't put this on the list, or speaking out, or like, what would you suggest for our listeners this morning in Connecticut?
Absolutely. Well, people everywhere can share information on social media. There are a lot of videos that have come out since this video, aired in August, that explain why this industry is so cruel. And as you say, it's a tourist issue. People from outside New York have a right to have an opinion on it as well. And, you know, they can call New York City Hall, and they can let Speaker Adams and Mayor Adams both know that this industry is not something that they want to see when they're visiting the city. And that they would support seeing electric carriages on the street instead of horses. Because, you know, the fact is, this one driver who was filmed, you know, whipping this poor horse has rightfully been painted as a villain, but the entire industry is complicit. And we've seen so many horses who are malnourished, like this horse was, who have collapsed in the street, who've gotten loose and run through traffic and collided with cars. This industry is really a danger to anyone in and around Central Park, including the tourists who are visiting. So really anyone who visits New York, absolutely does have a right to have an opinion and should let that opinion be known.
And is there like any kind of anything that PETA or any petitions that you know of that people can get their names on or anything that we can do to get the bill to move forward as well? Like anything else that people should know about that maybe they're not aware of?
Yes, people can go to our website, PETA.org, where we have a whole page about this with information that you can share and information on who you can contact. At City Hall, again, Speaker Adams is quite important right now to get this bill moving. And just let them know that people just do not want to see horses being abused in the middle of New York City in 2022. I think, as you said earlier, you just used the word archaic, and that's perfect. I mean, horses are just not meant to live in a big modern city like New York. They're not meant to work on blazing hot asphalt all day. They're parked, literally parked in stables that look like multi-story garages in Midtown at night. Mm. They're just deprived of everything that would add even a little bit of enrichment or joy to their lives. And the fact is, we just know too much about animals in this day and age to justify this. We know this is cruel.
Mm-hmm. And it's just so unnatural. I think if people really thought about the nature of a horse, putting them in the middle of the busiest city in the entire country just does not add up. It just doesn't equate. I'm sorry. It just doesn't make any sense. So, Ashley Byrne, I really appreciate you, the work that PETA does. And again, if people want information, what is the website for PETA if people want to get more involved?
It's PETA.org, and you can find a tab for horse-drawn carriages right on the front, you know, the front page of the website.
Okay. Ashley, I appreciate you. Thank you so much for your time.
Melissa, thank you so much for having me on and for having this discussion. It really is so important.
Oh, absolutely. And we'll continue to have it until we see something significant change for the horses and for this industry. So I thank you again. That is Ashley Byrne, who is a PETA director, talking about horse-drawn carriages in New York City right here on WICC.